Now let us move on to tradition 6, which reads as follows. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Now, this tradition is a great departure from our original views. And in the middle 1940s, we still thought that for good enterprises, the AA name ought to be available if they were primarily conducted by AA members. And so, with my full consent, we lent the AA name to an educational enterprise carried on by a great friend of mine. And the first effect of this was very good. In those days, of course, we hoped for more and more publicity. And when she went on the road educating the public, opening other facilities, she got a great lot of publicity, which brushed off on us because she had declared herself publicly as an AA member. Now, there were other instances of this, which were really menacing, where people borrowed the AA name, broke the anonymity at the public level, and therefore were in full cry to get us married to all sorts of other enterprises. And so by 1950, we had seen the extreme peril of giving endorsements to the public level or of AA members breaking the anonymity to public level and trying to draw the AA endorsement over onto enterprises of their own for purposes of raising money and all that's publicity. So that came crystal clear. Now we have a tradition 7 called every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Well, this took a long time for us to change our minds about. When our foundation, now the General Service Board, was first set up, we thought in terms of very large funds and thought ourselves very fortunate in getting some of Mr. John D. Rockefeller's friends to serve on the board, not only because they were deeply interested, but because it seemed an avenue to funds which certainly Mr. Rockefeller would supply. For a while, it looked like he would supply our newly formed foundation funds, especially when in the spring of 1940, 2 years after it started, he suddenly announced that he would like to give a dinner and invite his friends to hear the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sure enough, the night came. Nelson Rockefeller represented his father, who turned out to be sick. Harry Emerson Fosdick appeared, and a great many notables in finance and in other activities in and about New York. And there were in the room at least $1 billion of capital. And we who were still very broke, of course, expected that, we could make even a timid bid for contributions and get a very considerable return. To our utter astonishment, following the meeting, Mr. Rockefeller wrote a letter to all who came and all who were invited and hadn't, said what a remarkable thing this was, how much it represented first century Christianity, and how, in the interest of simplicity and spiritual values, it needed no money. And then he staked out a little exception, saying that a couple of the originators were still needful of a little help. And because of this, he was giving the movement $1,000. So each of the people present were impressed with the idea that no great amount of money was needed. One gave us as little as $10. And I think the highest contribution outside of Mr. Rockefeller was $300. Subsequently, Mr. Rockefeller's friend, Willard Richardson, then on the board, called on Mr. Rockefeller and again raised this question of money. And Mr. Rockefeller said, "Dick, money is going to spoil this thing. It ought to stand on its own feet." So we can certainly credit Mr. John D. Rockefeller for a providential wisdom on behalf of AA. And he since has told the story many times, and so has Nelson, how this is the only organization that paid back money that he loaned us at one period of an organization of this sort. So this is the taproot of our tradition of every AA group should be self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We have made a rather stringent rule or custom about contributions from individuals inside AA. Our rich people in AA are very numerous. A lot of them would be disposed to send General Headquarters a lot of money. But they and the rest of us feel that we should not pass off our financial responsibility onto people less fortunate. We should share the financial responsibility, and we should not accept gifts large enough so that they would tend to buy favor for trusteeships and whatnot. So the utmost that any individual can give AA today, that is any AA member, is $200 a year. All other contributions come from the groups themselves, and we have declined large sums of money from the outside, and it is my prayer that we shall always do so. Well, let us jump down to tradition 10. The professionalism and A as such should never be organized have been pretty well covered directly and by inference. But here we come to Tradition 10, which says that Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. Well, we've never had any great trouble along this line. And, of course, the anonymity tradition has tended to keep the lid on it. We have managed finally to refrain from endorsements or from being compromised by our own people in that direction, so that actually this issue has never arisen. And in this sense, we are very unique among societies and nations that we're in a position of absolute neutrality as far as world and the problems of our community are concerned. As a society, as individuals, we take all sorts of positions on these things, but as a society, we express no opinions on these issues, and therefore we don't get into arguments. And that would, of course, be a potent source of tremendous trouble if we ever got into such arguments. And we have had, historically, a situation that was drawn to our attention, I think, by Milton Maxwell, a good AA friend, a professor and sociologist, who once wrote up a series of pieces on the so-called Washingtonian movement. This flourished in the 1840s, and it was a society composed of alcoholics trying to help each other personally, encouraging the taking of pledges, and they had the benefit of the identification and some of the other attributes of AA. And I think they signed up in the first two or three years of their existence as many people as we now have in AA as recovered active members, something like 500,000. Well, this was very sensational. The Prohibition movement was getting under big head of steam at the time. And there were lots of other public issues. The Civil War was ahead. Slavery was an issue. This was an issue. That was an issue. It was not long before the Washingtonians had great torchlight processions, notably in New York and Baltimore. They filled Faneuil Hall, and this was truly a great sensation of the time and extremely newsworthy. There was great pressure upon Washingtonians to speak. Some turned out to be very good speakers. I believe some of them were paid speakers. But the speakers in the South were apt to get into other matters than drinking, and so were they in the North. For example, the Southern speakers didn't like the abolition idea, and the Northern speakers did, so they managed to hook the poor Washingtonians into that tremendous controversy before the war. Likewise, they got the Washingtonian name into all sorts of enterprises. They were on both sides of the wet-dry controversy and so on. And then the process of disintegration started, probably because in part their spiritual force generated by signing of pledges and getting together wasn't so great as ours. But very largely it was a disintegration because they had done things that were very natural to do, but which had turned out to be so utterly destructive. And it was this spectacle of the past brought before us as our traditions were evolving that confirmed that we were probably very much on the right track in this matter of no public controversy, in this question of paying our own bills, of this question of not becoming involved with other enterprises, and so on down the line. And above all, it confirmed the great protective value of our anonymity tradition. Now we come to tradition 11, a highly important one, which says that our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. I might remark right here that this film, by the way, is for the benefit of AAs and is not for public release. We had no public relations policy, excepting the fear of public relations, for the first 2 or 3 or 4 years of AA. Our societies, particularly in the West, our groups, of which there were only 2 or 3, were almost secret societies. In those days, if you'd posed the question of attraction versus promotion, the idea of attraction would be to sit on the front porch and wait for some drunks to come along asking for help. For example, there was severe condemnation of people in the Philadelphia group who had gone to Curtis Bach, the owner of the Saturday Post, and had asked him, would he be interested in taking a look at AA? Well, he did take a look and caused Jack Alexander to be assigned to do the famous March 1941 piece. Well, then, of course, the arena was wide open to all comers and contenders. And soon we began to get AAs who were rushing to microphones, using the AA name, breaking anonymity, all for the good of the movement, because even these broken anonymity situations brought in customers. And so therefore, they were doing good work. I now remember, too, that they thought that very often there should be a dual purpose here. This would be very good. I remember somebody ran down south for public office on what he called the AA ticket. I believe he wanted to become A district attorney, will he publicize the AA and his good intentions politically besides? And another fellow rushed to the microphone and announced that he was soon going to produce a series of talks on AA, and that these would be sponsored by his employer, the Gulf Insurance Company, etc. And we had a great time finding out where attraction left off and promotion began. Well, right then, it started to be evident that this attraction and promotion business represented two poles, and taken at their extremes, the conservative rabbit on the attraction theme was so conservative that his do-nothing policies would rot us for lack of action. And the promoters, if given their way, would publicize us from hell to breakfast with all of the panoply of the media, plus probably sound trucks too. In other words, the conservatives would rot us and the promoters would ruin us. So that the line between attraction and promotion got to be a matter of common sense interpretation. So this is finally settled. Now, it was seen, too, that anonymity was the prevention of most bad publicity. Because if people didn't scramble to the microphone with these mixed motives, and we didn't go too far in the way of promotion, or too far in the way of doing nothing, then we'd have a public relation policy that would include an ever-widening stream of people coming into AA and getting well. And now we come to tradition 12, and this one comprehends all of the traditions. Up to now, you have been listening to a recital, perhaps overlong, of the protective value of the traditions to our society. We have been talking very much in terms of simply averting calamity by taking prudent and unusual means and courses to do so. So now the question is posed by the listener, is there no more constructive or spiritual content to our traditions than simply the sum of our fears and anxieties and our efforts to protect ourselves from untoward evils and circumstances? Well, there certainly is. And all of these traditions have in them the elements of sacrifice. Sacrifice either by groups or by AA members. As we look back here, the common welfare tradition. People used to say, well, the drunk, he's the important guy. Well, surely he is. But how is he going to get well in any number if there is no fellowship? Therefore, the common welfare has to come first, and our individual welfare second. Likewise, we who have been prone to power driving have to yield to the idea that we may be instructed by the group conscience. We have thrown aside all ambition to be prominent in the alcohol field as a society. Our members go into these fields as individual citizens, and there they should be. But the society says, no, we will cleave to a single purpose. We have sacrificed the opportunity of raising very large sums of money for this society and for others by adopting the tradition declining outside contributions. Those of us who had special ambitions to be professional workers I don't mean service workers in an office. I mean face-to-face therapy for pay. These are legitimate ambitions, but not good enough. A professional class in AA might even lead to our destruction and certainly to our compromise. So professionalism is out. Those of us who are power-ridden would like to unconsciously, perhaps, and sometimes consciously, be more or less permanent governors of the destinies of AA. But now we see that our strength lies in letting go when our time comes. And this I recognize in myself. My time came some time ago, and our affairs have been under the management of our trustees almost without interference by me for these several years. And that's how it should be. But it represents a giving up, the sacrifice of ambitions, many of which would be legitimate in the world around us, all in the interest not only of the survival, but in the effectiveness and the joyousness of the life that we find in it and cherish so much. In our public relations, we have run contrary to all experience in the modern world. In the modern world, everything is proceeding upon the merits or demerits of highly publicized figures. Everything was working in terms of friction and controversy. Everything is working in terms of haves and have-nots, of large sums of money being transferred from one class to another. We do not decry these developments. We say that for our particular purpose, they're perilous. And so we think that it would be prudent to leave them alone. So there is a sacrificial quality that we do not conform to our traditions merely because we must to avoid personal calamity. We defer to these traditions because they seem right in principle and because we actually want them for ourselves. That while other courses might be good, for us this would be the best. In our case, the good could be very often the actual enemy of the best. Now then, I'd like to tell you a final anecdote, which is a bit self-serving. I've had a certain amount of reluctance to speak about it. But I would like to draw attention to the fact that Dr. Bob and I began to recognize in the late 1940s, that we had a special responsibility to set an example in the matter of the anonymity. The conformity with anonymity was not merely a compliance with the injunction that we should not have our full names and pictures published throughout the world. It was more than an avoidance of our names being made public. That it would extend also to the acceptance of special distinguishment and honors. This came up, and this sort of conversation between Dr. Bob and I began toward nearly the close of his life. He was fatally afflicted. This is well known. I was back and forth between here and Akron a great deal. He was, however, much up and around much of the time. And on this day, we sat talking, and he said, you know, I want to show you something, something that moves me very much in a way, and something, of course, which to me, I wouldn't say so to the would-be donors, has a sort of a comical aspect. And anyway, let me get your reaction. So he came and spread out on the floor a blueprint, which was a drawing of a medium-sized mausoleum in which he and Anne could repose when they were over the hill. And Dr. Bob looked at me and told about some of the people coming up and thinking that this sort of thing was needed because this occurred with other celebrated people and so forth. And of course, he had declined. And he turned to me, and with that priceless grin of his, said, Bill, I think you and I ought to get buried like other folks. Well, this set us thinking. Did we have some further obligation to this tradition of anonymity? And up to this point, there had been little nibbles that he'd had some, I'd had some, lesser universities, smaller ones that offered degrees of various kinds, and well, we'd kind of turned those down as a matter of course. But then we began to think, doesn't the tradition extend to this public honor business? Doesn't it extend to the acceptance of no rewards, even posthumous? And then Dr. Baum died, and he and Anne were then buried like other folks. She had been for a time. And pretty soon, a new set of temptations began to develop with me. Time magazine, some years ago, asked for a number of us to come over from the office. And I was included, of course. And they took us upstairs for a long, long lunch. And these people were top figures over there. And they listened to the AA story. And they said, well, now we've given you folks good treatment and we propose to keep it up. But now we would like, Bill, to have a biographical sketch of you. And we would like to make this a cover page. And let us tell you, before you say no, that if you make it a cover story, if we make this a cover story, it will enormously increase the impact of the piece, a dozen times maybe, over what the same piece without the cover would. And that our circulation is something like 12 million. Now, we would like to do the story of AA hung on a biographical sketch of you. And I said, about the anonymity. Oh, no, well, we're quite aware of that. We'll agree to keep that. You'd just have your head turned away from the camera. It'd be hardly a side view. That bald spot might show a little, but we'll stay within the rules and regulations. Well, I must confess that this proposal was a puzzler. I can honestly say that I didn't feel especially or personally tempted by the lure of a flesh and blood biographical account of myself. It didn't seem right that I should cooperate in such an effort. As for the anonymity, yes, they'd keep that, but then I began to wonder what the effect would be on the future. If I began giving sketches of this sort of myself to public media, even with my head turned, once Papa was out of the way and gone west, wouldn't other people say, well, the old man almost did it, so I'll give him my biography and full face on from here out. In other words, it would open the door subtly to power-driving people of the future, people just like me. Now, this was very hard to decline because declinations meant the death of some, and it meant the prolonged illness of others. The impact of this thing could have been enormous and brought in great numbers of people. So the saying no was something to keep awake nights about, and I did. I hope and believe that this was the right decision for AA's future. But again, for a long time, the specters of the people who died and those who might have recovered earlier has continued to haunt me. It was a question of making an estimate whether the nearby advantage of this would be of more value to more people than the advantage of an example that would include the acceptance of public honors in the AA anonymity tradition. And I have opted for the latter choice. It is the best that I can do. I leave it to you and to the future for whatever it may be worth. So, in conclusion, dear folks, a thousand thanks for sitting with me and to the camera crowd out there. And, dear people, at great distances, please have my warmest affection and gratitude. And may God bless you and Alcoholics Anonymous forever.